lodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shining light.
Freedom to travel safely and quickly and comfortably on our highways is not a little freedom, but a big one. People in their own communities are getting together to do something.
I'm Helen Rathburn, the fourth grade teacher at the new elementary school. I came here today just to listen. I didn't expect to say anything. But after hearing some of the arguments against the new highway proposal, I would like to say just one thing. I work all day with children, and they're your children. Your children will have a better country to live in because of these new roads. Can't you see that this highway means a whole new way of life for the children?
O Almighty God, who has given us this earth and has appointed men to have domination over it, who has commanded us to make straight the highways, to lift up the valleys, and to make the mountains low. Bless these, our nation's road builders.
Don't honk your horn. Raise your voice. Ask for better highways and more parking space. It's your country. Give yourself the green light.
You're listening to episode 668 of Unwelcome Guests, Big Oil at Home and Abroad. I'm Robin Upton, and the clips you've just heard come from a documentary, Taken for a Ride, which we're going to be adapting in the second part of the show, which looks at the impact of Big Oil and the road lobby on US domestic policy. Why do cars seem almost essential for adult life in the US? What happened to public transport systems? Now, the first part of the show looks instead at the impact of Big Oil on US foreign policy, specifically on the Middle East. Now, the inspiration for this show came from the following two-part radio adaptation of the English Al Jazeera documentary, The Secrets of the Seven Sisters, and it's by Unwelcome Guests Collective member Kenneth Doust, who produced it for his own show, New World Notes.
This is a story about the Seven Sisters, which is to say, Big Oil. The term Seven Sisters was coined in the 1950s. It referred to the Anglo-American cartel that controlled the large majority of the world's oil, including all the oil in the Middle East. The Seven Sisters were five big American companies, plus Royal Dutch Shell and the Anglo-Persian Oil Company, now BP. Because of industry mergers, the original Seven Sisters are now four: ExxonMobil, Chevron, Shell, and BP. They don't have quite the power or the global monopoly they did 50 years ago, but they are still more powerful than any government in the West, especially the United States. Which is why the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere has just reached the catastrophic level of 400 parts per million, and the speed of global warming is rapidly increasing, and there has been no move by anyone in government to reduce our burning of fossil fuels. It's why BP could do catastrophic damage to the Gulf of Mexico and our southern states, and receive for its crimes only the mildest slap on the wrist. Or was it a kiss? The power of Big Oil is why Obama will approve the Keystone XL pipeline, the environment be damned. It is why the U.S. Army and CIA are now all over the oil-rich parts of Africa. It is why the U.S. destroyed Iraq, except its oil industry, and why we are fighting to conquer Afghanistan, and why the United States has oil-rich Iran and oil-rich Venezuela in its sights. Remember Gaddafi of Libya? Did I mention that Libya has lots of oil? Why do you think Hitler sent Rommel there to conquer the place? Did you know that Somalia has lots of oil? Don't get me started. There's a good new video documentary out called The Secret of the Seven Sisters. The first part of it is especially relevant to America today. It focuses on our control of the Middle East, and it's a wonderful quick refresher course in 20th century history. This is history that the ruling elite does not want us old folks to remember, and does not want the young folks to know in the first place. And so far, they've pretty much gotten their wish. The film is about how Big Oil came to control or even own all the oil in the Middle East. They got it by massively bribing the country's corrupt kings. They gave both huge bribes of money and the promise that the British and United States governments would keep their corrupt ruling families in power. The Saud dynasty in Arabia, the Pahlavi dynasty in Iran. The film is also about how the peoples of the Middle East, and even the democratic governments of the Middle East, tried to regain some control over their own country's mineral wealth, tried to wrestle some oil profits away from the Seven Sisters, and use them to benefit their own country. And the film is about how, time after time, the United States overthrew those democratic governments in the Middle East and established brutal dictatorships in their place. Next time you hear our president or secretary of state prattle about the U.S.'s great support for democracy worldwide, I hope you'll recall that in the 1950s, Iraq had a democratic government. The democratic government threatened to reduce the profits of Big Oil. The United States overthrew the democracy in Iraq and put the dictator Saddam Hussein into power, and kept him in power for a half century. In the 1950s, Iran had a democratic government which threatened the profits of Big Oil. At BP's request, the United States overthrew Iran's democracy and made Shah Mohammad Reza Pahlavi dictator of Iran, and then snatched much of Iran's oil away from BP and gave it to the U.S.-based big oil companies. Gave it to those sisters whose maiden name had been Rockefeller. As for Saudi Arabia, they never had a democracy, and the U.S. has helped the ruling family keep it that way. So, on to the documentary. The title is The Secret of the Seven Sisters. It starts with a prologue. The reporter is traveling by car in oil-rich Iraq today. His Iraqi driver is having a hard time finding gasoline for sale. Wherever Iraq's oil may be going, it's apparently no longer going to the Iraqis.
Iraq, Iran, and Kuwait. This documentary is on the trail of the Seven Sisters cartel. The investigation leads to Kirkuk in northern Iraq. It's 50 degrees in the shade. There are endless checkpoints and controls. The war has left its mark. In the heart of the Middle East, Iraq, one of the latest battlefields in the Great Oil War. This old American taxi is a gas guzzler, constantly hungry for fuel. The driver seeks out the local petrol peddlers. In oil-rich Iraq, it's not easy filling a tank.
Okay.
Who is responsible for that?
أحنا أهل النفط. ها العالم كله يحكي بالعراق بالنفط اللي بالعراق. الأمريكان جابهم طمعهم.
With multiple attacks and kidnappings, insecurity is rife amongst the derricks and wells. The taxi driver, Ali, calls the route to Kirkuk the road to hell. Oil had previously been found in the Middle East, but never in such quantities. In 1927, it gushed from the ground in Kirkuk. The violence of the discharge caused five casualties. Iraq's oil was already wreaking its wrath. But the real story, the secret story of oil, begins elsewhere. In Scotland, in the heart of the Highlands. On August 28, 1928, in Achnacarry Castle. Three men have an appointment here. A Dutchman, an American, and an Englishman. This pheasant and grouse hunt was never filmed. There are no photos or archive records. But this is probably how it happened. The Dutchman is Henry Detterding, an implacable and determined man, nicknamed the Napoleon of Oil. Having exploited a find in Sumatra, he joined forces with a rich ship owner and painted shell salesman. The two men founded Royal Dutch Shell. The American is Walter C. Teagle. He represents the Standard Oil Company, founded by John D. Rockefeller at the age of 31, the future Exxon. Wells, transport, refining and distribution, everything is controlled by Standard, an omnipotent, many-headed beast. In 1911, Rockefeller was ordered to dismantle his trust and form 34 separate companies. And yet they all remained under the control of the century's first billionaire. The Englishman, Sir John Cadman, director of the Anglo-Persian Oil Company, soon to become BP. On the initiative of the brilliant young First Lord of the Admiralty, Winston Churchill, the British government took a stake in BP, and the Royal Navy switched from coal to oil. The First World War would validate this decision. With fuel-hungry ships, planes, and tanks, oil became the blood of every battle. The new automobile industry was developing fast, and the Ford T was selling by the million. The world was thirsty for oil, and companies were waging a merciless contest. But the competition was making the market unstable. It was time to reach an agreement. Their names are Royal Dutch Shell, Standard Oil, and the Anglo-Persian Oil Company. Today, Shell, Exxon, and BP, the biggest oil companies in the world. Back at the castle, the leading lights of the oil trade are seated, and their secret meeting can begin. Henry Detterding declares, "It is time to exploit, fraternally and to the greatest profit, the world's oil resources. Production zones, transport costs, sale prices, everything must be agreed and shared." In the early hours, an agreement is reached. A secret pact is sealed, but with no signatures. The great oil cartel can prepare to dominate the world.
1928, c'est le moment où, en effet, les compagnies pétrolières, les grandes
compagnies. In 1928, the great oil companies decided, through the Achnacarry agreements, to share oil prices and production zones by forming a cartel. The countries were kept in the dark, as were their governments and the producing countries. It was all done in the greatest secrecy and amorality. We'd have to wait until the early 1950s for the details of the agreement finally to leak out. Journalist Eric Laurent.
Pour que le détail de ces accords puisse enfin commencer à filtrer.
On this morning of August 29, 1928, the world order has changed. Other companies would join the billionaires' conspiracy. History will call them the Seven Sisters. Exxon, Shell, BP, Mobil, Texaco, Gulf, and Chevron. The story of the Seven Sisters takes us to Tehran. In the early 20th century, the oil companies fought bitterly here to control Persia's vast oil assets. At the end of the First World War, through the Sykes-Picot agreements, then the Treaty of San Remo, France and Britain divided up the Middle East. The American oil companies were enraged. What could be done? The solution came from an Armenian, Khorlats Gulbenkian, the greatest oil broker of all time. Gulbenkian drew a red line tracing the perimeters of future oil extraction zones, forbidding competition and demanding mutual assistance within the red line area. The Iraq Petroleum Company was created. BP, Shell, Exxon, and the French SFP, the future Total, were equal shareholders. The Seven Sisters controlled the Middle East's known oil reserves. Gulbenkian claimed 5% of every contract.
Pierre Terzian, Director, Petrostrategies.
Les contrats de concession, qui étaient de petits textes.
The contracts were short, only 15 or 20 pages. Through them, the states conceded almost all their territory. How ignorant they were to do such a thing. These oil people bought up whole countries, or at least their resources, with documents barely 15 to 20 pages long.
For the British, the Abadan refinery in Iran was the jewel in the crown, the biggest refinery in the world. The Iranians never had access to the company's accounts. The royalties paid to the Iranian state were negligible, but sufficient to satisfy the reigning monarch, Mohammad Reza Shah Pahlavi, and by his silence. The Anglo-Persian was a state within a state, where the law and the lifestyle were consummately British. The Seven Sisters ruled over the Middle East and its oil, oil which had to flow with no interruption towards Europe and the United States.
Professor Michael Clare of Hampshire College.
Delivery of oil to the public is a crucial requirement of any person who wants to remain in office. And one has to understand the importance of oil to the American way of life to understand why politicians see their job as, in large part, if they're in foreign policy, is in procuring adequate supplies of oil to meet American needs. It explains why President Roosevelt, in his last months when he was ailing, felt it necessary to meet with the King of Saudi Arabia, Abdulaziz ibn Saud.
Oil requirements were ever increasing. On his way back from the Yalta Conference on February 14, 1945, President Roosevelt anchored his ship, the USS Quincy, near the Suez Canal. He had a meeting with the King of Arabia, Abdulaziz ibn Saud. Nothing would be signed, but they reconvened an agreement made in 1936, opening the doors of the Kingdom of Arabia to American oil companies. In exchange for the oil, the king demanded protection for his country and gold, a great deal of gold. The kingdom's fortune was sealed by an English adventurer, Harrison John Filby, a spy, explorer, and writer who'd been entrusted, along with a certain Colonel Lawrence, with organizing the Arab revolt. Having converted to Islam, Filby sided with Ibn Saud against his own country and participated in the creation of the Kingdom of Arabia. In 1936, on his advice, Ibn Saud sold the kingdom's oil rights to the Americans. Aramco was founded, a consortium combining Exxon, Chevron, Mobil, and Texaco.
Sheikh Ahmed Zaki Yamani, Saudi Minister of Petroleum from 1962 to 1986.
All these companies like Aramco in the old days, they were a state within the state. Saudi Arabia cannot have a law controlling Aramco. Aramco has the power to produce the oil, to export the oil at the price they decide. Saudi Arabia has no power except to raise their hands to get the money they give them. And this was the relationship.
Arabian oil production began in 1946, shortly after the meeting between Roosevelt and Ibn Saud. 20,000 Americans were billeted to Dahran in eastern Arabia. In theory, the oil men were merely the king's guests, as no one could purchase the Prophet's holy lands. But in fact, Aramco set the rules for the king, its greatest ally. The American company's only obligation was to shower the king and his 3,000 princes with gold. The desert's oil resources proved to be fabulous, the greatest treasure trove of all time. The United States and Saudi Arabia were wedded, for better or for worse, oil and dollars. Despite the ensuing crises, there has been no divorce. It was here in Washington in 1952 that the Seven Sisters Cartel was summoned to face the Supreme Court for the first time. The Federal Trade Commission was investigating their commercial practices and illicit arrangements. President Harry Truman received a confidential memo from Edgar Hoover, the director of the FBI. But the investigation was blocked. The trial would never take place. What was good for the Seven Sisters was good for America. In Tehran, the bazaar is the heart and pulse of the Iranian capital. It was here in 1951 that the first revolt against British petroleum began. The bazaaris, the middle classes, the Tudor party communists and Shia religious leaders took to the streets. Their action was triggered by BP's refusal to meet improved wage claims. The workers launched a strike which paralyzed Abadan, the huge oil terminal.
This was absolutely crucial source of wealth to what remained of the British Empire after World War II.
Michael Clare.
And it was also a symbol of white Anglo-Saxon superiority. And the histories of the time make it very clear that for the British, the Iranians were viewed as third-class citizens, as if they were black.
An uprising was sparked. A nationalist MP, Dr. Mohammad Mossadegh, was the movement's leader. In Parliament, he was known as Mossadegh al-Saltaneh, a man of proven honesty. His program was simple: nationalize the oil.
Faribord's Race Dana, historian. Dr. Mossadegh was accused of radicalism, which of course isn't true. He had identified the central problem: recovering the oil that had been confiscated.
Under pressure from Parliament, the Shah appointed Mossadegh Prime Minister. On the very next day, May 1, 1951, Mossadegh led the vote for the nationalization of Iran's oil. The army occupied the oil fields, but the Iranians were not qualified to keep operations going. 3,000 British technicians and their families left the country, and the British Navy blockaded the ports.
Pierre Terzian. There was extraordinary pandemonium around the world. The Western countries declared Iranian petrol off-limits. Anyone buying Iranian oil would be taken to court. So Iran could no longer sell its oil to anyone. Any tankers leaving Iranian ports were seized.
Iran and Dr. Mossadegh had to be punished. The British Prime Minister Winston Churchill asked the Americans to help. The CIA stepped in. Countless dollars were distributed to pay off members of parliament and leading army officers. The coup d'etat operation was given the codename Ajax. It was coordinated by Kermit Roosevelt, the president's nephew and a CIA agent.
There was a military coup. Democrat generals, communists and nationalists were shot. Dr. Mossadegh was sent into exile. Iran was submerged with fear, and the oil companies regained their old power.
Five 5,000 of the coup's opponents were shot and killed. Mossadegh was arrested and sentenced to death, a sentence later reduced to exile. On August 24, 1953, the monarch, Reza Shah, returned in triumph. Having organized the coup d'etat, The Americans claimed their reward. BP had to make way for the US companies. Now present in both Iran and Saudi Arabia, the USA controlled two of the planet's biggest black gold producers.
It was common practice. The fact that the CIA intervened in Iran to establish foreign oil companies is not unusual for that time. The American oil companies are so powerful that they can easily choose to make or break a government. What is exceptional is that one man stood up, Mossadegh, and it resulted in failure. That had a major effect. For several years, no one dared to move a muscle.
The shockwave created by Mossadegh did move towards Suez, however. Egypt had never benefited from the huge revenues generated by the canal, shared by France and Britain. On July 26, 1956, President Nasser declared the nationalization of the canal. A British, French, and Israeli coalition attacked Egypt. Port Said at the entrance to the canal was bombarded and Egyptian forces crushed. Nasser sunk concrete-laden ships in the canal and all traffic was blocked. Under American and Soviet pressure, the Anglo-French forces were forced to withdraw. For Nasser, a military defeat became a political victory. Nasserism and Arab nationalism were born on the banks of the Suez Canal.
The nationalization of the Suez Canal, unlike the oil in Iran, was a success. That had a profound effect. It showed it was possible to succeed, to oppose the Western countries, and in certain cases, it could work.
A political victory for the Arab countries, but an economic victory for the oil companies. The closure of the canal led to a substantial rise in crude oil prices, huge profits for the Seven Sisters. The rise enabled them to pay for the building of a new generation of ships, supertankers. And the Cape of Good Hope became the new maritime route for oil transportation. Baghdad, translatable as the Garden of Peace. For the people of this city, there is neither war nor peace. But worse, a living nightmare every day, a life of uncertainty. It was here, on the banks of the Tigris, that the Seven Sisters would pay for their sins, vanity and greed. The sisters were greedy. Despite the havoc caused by the Suez crisis, Shell and BP decided to cut the buying price of oil by 9%, under the pretext of overproduction. It was the Seven Sisters' first mistake. On September 10th, 1960, representatives from Venezuela, Saudi Arabia, Iraq, Iran, and Kuwait all met in Baghdad. After 4 days of discussion, they agreed to found OPEC, the Organization of Petrol Exporting Countries. Their objective: to collectively fix the sale price of their oil.
Sheikh Yamani, former Saudi oil minister.
Well, the Western countries did not really feel that this little organization will be powerful. So they ignore it. The oil companies also, being very powerful, they ignored it. Not only this, they refused to mention the word OPEC. And I know for sure that America was working very hard to convince some countries in the Gulf not to join this, including Saudi Arabia.
It's a nice overview of 20th century history with a focus on Middle Eastern oil. To me, the documentary suggests three conclusions. First, the Anglo-American corporate oil cartel is a massive illegal price-fixing machine that for many decades simply stole the mineral wealth of the Middle East. And they got very rich and very powerful in the process. Second conclusion, the United States government, including its army and CIA, protects the profits of these big private oil corporations, no matter what the human cost. That includes overthrowing governments, replacing democracies with dictatorships, and starting wars. Last week, we heard how, in 1951, the U.S. destroyed Iran's democratic government, led by Prime Minister Mohammad Mossadegh. We replaced him with a brutal dictator, the Shah. Along the same lines, this week we'll hear how the U.S. gave Saddam Hussein of Iraq our permission to invade Kuwait. Then we started Gulf War I because we were shocked, to find that Saddam Hussein had invaded Kuwait. I'll just mention that this was all perfectly obvious at the time, in 1991. We knew even then exactly what U.S. Ambassador April Glaspie had said to Saddam Hussein the day before Saddam invaded Kuwait. And that was, essentially, it's no business of ours. The third conclusion is that, ever since World War II, there's been constant conflict and war in the Middle East. And the more conflict there is in the Middle East, the higher the oil prices rise, and the richer the big oil companies get. The more war, the more death, the bigger the oil companies' profits. So, don't look for peace in the Middle East anytime soon. Well, those are my conclusions, and please feel free to draw your own. Let's pick up the story in 1960. Finally, the oil-producing countries got together and formed their own cartel, OPEC, to resist the plunder of the oil company cartel. Here is Sheikh Ahmed Zaki Yamani, who was Saudi Arabia's Minister of Petroleum from 1962 to 1986.
Well, the Western countries did not really feel that this little organization will be powerful. So they ignore it. The oil companies also, being very powerful, they ignored it. Not only this, they refuse to mention the word OPEC. And I know for sure that America was working very hard to convince some countries in the Gulf not to join this, including Saudi Arabia.
The creation of OPEC was greeted in the West with indifference, skepticism, and scorn. The Washington Post wrote, OPEC, a belligerent conglomerate of camel-riding emirates. The West's overt contempt disgruntled the new leader in Iraq, Saddam Hussein. On June 1, 1972, without any notice, he nationalized the Iraq Petroleum Company. It put an end to the concession regimes which had handed over Iraq's oil to the majors for some 50 years.
Pierre Terzian, Director, PetroStrategies.
Lorsqu'en 1972, l'Irak a nationalisé...
Iraq nationalized the oil consortium, the Iraq Petroleum Corporation, in 1972. Apart from a few Westerners, the company's directors were all Iraqis. The technicians were Iraqi, and so were the engineers and economists. So Iraq's nationalization of its oil was authentic.
The American majors were furious. Foreseeing this, Saddam Hussein called on the Soviet Union. Moscow supplied technical and military support. Then he turned to the French. France needed oil. Iraq, arms. The deal was a foregone conclusion. Arab oil nationalization and the creation of OPEC. This time, the Seven Sisters' power seemed to be severely undermined. Strangely enough, the Arab-Israeli conflict would serve the Seven Sisters' cause. In the midst of the Jewish Yom Kippur holiday, the Day of Atonement, in October 1973, Egypt and Syria attacked Israel. The surprise was total, and the Israeli defense lines were overcome. The fourth Arab-Israeli conflict had begun.
Xavier Uzel, oil trader. Il est certain que le drame israélo-palestinien. The Israeli-Palestine drama was an alibi. It is fortunate for the rest of the world, as consumers of Middle East's oil, that, as a result of the conflict, countries in the region remained divided. They deprived themselves of the means to improve their strategies and oil prices. That would have made them the richest countries in the world.
Armed and equipped by the United States, and empowered by their aerial supremacy, the Israelis' counteroffensive was victorious. As a reprisal to the Americans' support, Arab members of OPEC decided on a series of price rises. OPEC emerged from the shadows of scorn and indifference. After the nationalization of oil in Iraq, Iran, Libya, and Algeria, OPEC covered 70% of the world's oil. It announced a complete embargo against the United States and Holland, and it also embargoed shipments to Rotterdam, a major oil terminal.
We, according to our philosophy,
Sheikh Yamani,
we don't use oil as a penalty, a punishment, but as a political instrument to attract the attention that there is a problem between the Arabs and the Israelis. Some other oil producers within OPEC, they wanted to punish America.
In Washington in 1973, a wind of panic was blowing. Automobiles ground to a halt, and the world turned in slow motion.
President Richard Nixon.
In recent months, we have taken many actions to increase supplies and to reduce consumption. But even with our best efforts, we knew that a period of temporary shortages was inevitable. Unfortunately, our expectations for this winter have now been sharply altered by the recent conflict in the Middle East.
Strengthened by the capacity of their stocks and the staggering cost of a barrel, the Seven Sisters could boast colossal profits. Exxon doubled its revenues.
I was against increasing the price of oil, and they attacked me for that. But I knew for sure that very high prices will have a reaction. The reaction happened, but you don't come to oil producers who can make a lot of money and tell them, no, don't make a lot of money. They don't consider the strategy. Strategy, because when you raise the price of oil, you enable the oil companies to use the extra money to explore for oil. And this is what happened in the North Sea, in Mexico, and elsewhere. So the level of production outside OPEC took place, competing with the price of OPEC.
OPEC thought it had won the battle, but in fact, it had lost the war. The 1973 oil crisis was a gigantic manipulation. The Seven Sisters needed money, huge sums, to finally prepare for drilling the offshore zones in the North Sea. The Yom Kippur War, OPEC's embargo, and the rise in prices all benefited the Seven Sisters. The Arab countries were playing their enemy's game. In 1975, the Shah of Iran was the key player in the global oil game. Saudi Arabia was too weak, Iraq too threatening. And so with Nixon's blessing, the Shah became the Gulf's gendarme.
Professor Michael Clare.
And the Shah of Iran became an American puppet rather than a British puppet. In addition to the diplomatic and public face of U.S. support for the Shah, the U.S. also provided him with military assistance and assistance to his police forces and the secret police, SAVAK, the secret police of the Shah. And it was the secret police that was implicated in the repression and the slaughter of the Shiite clergy and other dissident groups inside Iran.
In exile in France, in Nofle-le-Château, the Shah's fiercest opponent, Ayatollah Khomeini, made a solemn appeal for resistance. A strike in the oil sector, he said, is an act of obedience to God. His message was heard. Not a single drop of oil was extracted. The people were in the streets, and the Shah's days were numbered.
2 mois après les grèves dans l'industrie pétrolière iranienne,
2 months after the strikes in the Iranian oil industry, the workers called for a complete shutdown of oil production. I remember the Americans saying a few days later, "We now know that with the Shah of Iran in place, there will be no oil production." It was clear to everyone that the Shah's fate was sealed. The oil that had overthrown Mossadegh was about to overthrow the Shah.
The Americans and their oil companies turned their backs on the emperor. Turmoil was not good for business. Sick and broken, the monarch left Iran. Only the Egyptian president Anwar Sadat deigned to receive him. Reza Shah would only be authorized to enter the United States 1 year later to die of cancer. Ayatollah Khomeini returned to Tehran in triumph. The West believed it could cope with the change in regime. Religious authority was better than communism. The USSR was far too close to Iran, but the Americans severely underestimated the new Shia government's anger and resentment. At congregational prayers on Friday, the same slogans can be heard as at the time of the Ayatollah more than 30 years ago. In 1979, for America, the oil companies and the Sunni Arab world, Iraq was the new ally. The secular regime in Baghdad was a shield against the Iranian Shia fundamentalists. In 1981, Saddam Hussein invaded Iran with everyone's blessing. The second oil crisis began, and the war was a sinister godsend for the Seven Sisters. The price of crude oil skyrocketed. For both the companies and the producing countries, petrodollars rained down in abundance.
So in the chaos of this moment of the Iranian Revolution in 1980, Saddam Hussein invaded Iran. And I believe his intention was to seize the southwestern part of the country where most of Iran's oil fields are located. He was somewhat successful at first, but then the Iranian Revolution mobilized young people, the Iranian Revolutionary Guards, and drove Saddam Hussein out of Iran and began to press into Iraq itself. And this caused a great deal of anxiety in the West, in Saudi Arabia and Kuwait, which began to fear the success of the Iranians, who were Shiites. And so they began supporting Saddam Hussein.
8 years of war took a heavy toll. More than 1 million casualties and extensive oil facilities destroyed on both sides.
Oil trader Xavier Uzel.
On a fait la guerre durant.
We waged it because one country had to be used to destroy the other. The producing countries benefit from the oil bonanza. They build up financial reserves, and from time to time, they have to be bled.
The return of peace raised a question for the majors. Could peace lead to overproduction? The answer came from Kuwait. The Emirate increased its own production by 20%. Oil prices fell immediately. In addition, the Emir refused to cancel the $15 billion debt contracted by Iraq. Saddam felt betrayed by his former allies, who had all profited from the conflict.
Mohammed Ali Zaini, former Iraq representative to OPEC.
The major country which really kept overproducing and kind of assumed some intransigent mode was Kuwait. And that's what really pressured Saddam, because he really needed the money. Every time the price went $1 down, Iraq would lose $1 billion.
This was too much for Saddam Hussein, who informed the United States Ambassador April Glaspie of his intention to send military forces into Kuwait. She replied that this was an internal matter between two neighboring countries. The dictator was led to believe the U.S. would not intervene. On August 2, 1990, Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait.
And so only a short period after meeting the American ambassador, Iraq invaded Kuwait. And if you ask me, was this a trap? I would say yes. Saddam fell into that trap 100%.
The net around Saddam was tightening. It was unthinkable for the American administration to allow the Iraqi dictator to confiscate Kuwait's oil. In 1991, in just a few days, the Iraqi forces were crushed.
As Commander-in-Chief, I can report to you, our armed forces fought with honor and valor. And as President, I can report to the nation, aggression is defeated, the war is over.
But the new world order sought by President Bush began in a raging inferno. It would take 9 months to extinguish the fires at some 750 wells sabotaged by the Iraqi troops.
Journalist Eric Laurent.
Kuwait
has always been seen as the Bush family's backyard. George Bush Sr., the president at the time, made his fortune through his oil company called Zapata by obtaining drilling rights in Kuwait's offshore oil fields after World War II.
At the beginning of the 20th century, this stretch of sand seized by Iraqi tribesmen lived under the protection of the British Empire. A small pearl fishing port that served the British Navy en route to India. In 1938, oil flowed from the Kuwaiti desert. The tiny emirate, a mere patch of sand, proved to be a veritable oil sponge. American and British companies exploited this desert treasure and made fortunes for themselves, for the emir, and his subjects.
Carmel Al-Harami, Kuwaiti oil analyst.
It was like an earthquake. It changed the whole face of Kuwait society. All of a sudden, we were in the press. All of a sudden, we were the biggest oil producer in the world. All of a sudden, we have the wealth. And from basically very basic living standard, you know, barely, you know, having food or barely having proper clothes, and all of a sudden, here we are. The doors of heaven open to us.
In January 2001, George W. Bush's Vice President Dick Cheney launched an energy policy development group, the Energy Task Force. The aims of this commission were surrounded in absolute secrecy. For the Washington Post, it was a secret society. More than ever, the American administration appeared to be an extension of the oil lobby. Dick Cheney, a former president of Halliburton, Condoleezza Rice, a former executive with Chevron, all committed to the oil company's cause.
En 2003, la commission est tout de même contrainte par un jugement d'une cour d'appel.
In 2003, a federal court required the Cheney Commission to release several documents. One document is very interesting. It's a map of Iraq, dividing the part that's close to Saudi Arabia into 8 oil extraction zones. Oil was central to the strategy of this commission. Oil and Iraq.
The September 11th attacks to the heart of the American dream unleash unprecedented violence. Terrorism, weapons of mass destruction. The 9/11 tragedy is a long-awaited pretext. With the world's second-largest oil reserves, Iraq is designated as a response to America's energy requirements.
Iraq continues to flaunt its hostility toward America and to support terror. The Iraqi regime has plotted to develop anthrax and nerve gas and nuclear weapons for over a decade. States like these and their terrorist allies constitute an axis of evil, arming to threaten the peace of the world.
Baghdad.
This is a city in ruin. The calm waters of the Tigris form the horizon line from the Al Mansour Hotel.
Ships in the Gulf. A big explosion less than a mile from our hotel that followed this, the first hit on the government.
From these balconies, the world witnessed the American raids on the capital on television. When bombs hurled by invisible aircraft seemed to raise the city into the skies. On March 20th, 2003, the second Gulf War had just begun. In less than 3 weeks, the Abrams tanks leading Operation Iraqi Freedom reached the outskirts of Baghdad. The US troops' first mission was to secure the oil wells.
The first orders given to the military were to secure the oil installations. That was the priority. And to secure the oil ministry in Baghdad. Shortly after Saddam Hussein was overthrown, when the American troops entered Baghdad, the ministries were all pillaged. But when you saw the oil ministry, it was surrounded by armored vehicles, with a lot of Marines posted around it. This ministry was never touched, and not wrecked by demonstrators.
Ten years after the end of the war, the city still seems to be under siege. In Paradise Square, a new statue symbolizes the newfound freedom. It stands on the same base as the statue of Saddam Hussein that was pulled down on April 9, 2003. Was it the toppling of a dictator, or simply a war for oil?
That in the minds of Dick Cheney and George Bush and the others, this was a coincidence of interests, a convergence of interests, that a strategic advantage would be accomplished by eliminating Saddam Hussein and putting a pro-American regime in power in Iraq. And at the same time, that would make available the oil fields of Iraq for exploitation by American companies.
The Americans claim to be introducing a new world order in the Middle East and winning the so-called war on terror. NGOs, for their part, report more than 120,000 civilian victims. Chaos ruled. The Sunnis, the Shias, the Kurds. The war in Iraq continued among sectarian militia. In reality, the American invasion, with its whiff of petrol, merely spread the stench of death.
One says that the Iraq is the oil Eldorado. Well, this is indeed true. So it is really the last frontier, let us say. It is the last province that can be open one day to international oil companies, and then they come and they find these super giant fields which are no more in the rest of the world.
Chinese, Russian, American, more than 150 companies jostle for position. And the stakes are high. Iraq's oil fields, the world's second biggest oil reserves. In 2009, contracts were signed, and the oil fields of West Qurna, Majnoon, and Rumaila were attributed to ExxonMobil, Shell, and BP. The Seven Sisters are very much present. Once again, they come out on top. Since the notorious hunting party at Aknakari Castle, they have never ceased to plot, to plan, and to scheme. Basically, to manipulate the course of world history.
And that documentary was by Al Jazeera, published earlier this year. Now, let's have a quick music break. This is a slightly cut version of Once Again 2 by the Welfare Poets.
Hey yo, this is going out to Barry, yo. And all those spirit and mama signs. I hope y'all still reachable. I know this psychosis is treatable. All our tracks are eatable. You can even use this song as a teaching tool.
One, two, one, two, one, four, five, one. Look, the planet is dying, so you can keep the change. My job options are still dying. My mother weeps the same. We tear muscles to own rubble, borrow money from Big Trouble or Little China, while the city breathes decay. Some people cried my head when they made you a made man, lord of the light, whore of the angels. Boots on the ground and death from above, like Libya or Pakistan today. He supports Al-Qaeda in Syria. So where do his loyalties really lie at? Why is he spying on you and I from a phone jack? That's why he's giving out all of these phones black. His water off a duck's back, opium in a rucksack, crude petroleum in Iraq. Same different toilet, Tennessee Titans to Houston Oilers. How many bankers got knocked off and robbing all us? None, yet the public interest suffers while money swells from his war chest. And this is fascism, Mein Kampf, and all hails. The only industry growth has been international arms sales. And that's a fact, look it up, it's in the book. So let it be known, the payloads delivered by army drones throughout the developing world is cause for the poultry to march home. The care packages, cash loans for the big banks and the Dow Jones, and the foreclosed brownstones is evidence of the false hope. He holds, so let it be known they grow. Once again, always and forever. Welfare poets.
Sister from the continent.